You're listening to WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today, you'll hear a conversation with the author Pam Jenoff about her new novel, The Orphan's Tale, published by Mira Books. Pam Jenoff was born in Maryland and raised outside of Philadelphia. She attended George Washington University in Washington, D.C., and Cambridge University in England. Upon receiving her master's in history from Cambridge, she accepted an appointment as special assistant to the Secretary of the Army. The position provided a unique opportunity to witness and participate in operations at the most senior levels of government, including helping the families of the Pan Am Flight 103 victims secure their memorial at Arlington National Cemetery, observing recovery efforts at the site of the Oklahoma City bombing, and attending ceremonies to commemorate the 50th anniversary of World War II. Following her work at the Pentagon, Pam moved to the State Department. In 1996, she was assigned to the U.S. consulate in Krakow, Poland. It was during this period that she developed her expertise in Polish, Jewish relations, and the Holocaust. Working on matters such as preservation of Auschwitz and the restitution of Jewish property in Poland, Pam developed close relations with the surviving Jewish community. She left the Foreign Service in 1998 to attend law school and graduated from the University of Pennsylvania. She worked for several years as a labor and employment attorney, both at a firm and in-house in Philadelphia, and now she teaches law school at Rutgers. She is the author of The Commandant's Girl, which was an international bestseller and nominated for a Quill Award, as well as The Winter Guest, The Diplomat's Wife, The Ambassador's Daughter, Almost Home, A Hidden Affair, and The Things We Cherished. She also authored a short story in the anthology Grand Central, Original Post-War Stories of Love and Reunion. She lives outside of Philadelphia with her husband and three children. Her new book, The Orphan's Tale, is a powerful novel of friendship set in a traveling circus during World War II. It introduces two extraordinary women and their harrowing stories of sacrifice and survival. 16-year-old Noah has been cast out in disgrace after becoming pregnant by a Nazi soldier and being forced to give up her baby. She lives above a small rail station, which she cleans in order to earn her keep. When Noah discovers a boxcar containing dozens of Jewish infants bound for a concentration camp, she's reminded of the child that was taken from her. And in a moment that will change the course of her life, she snatches one of the babies and flees into the snowy night. Noah finds refuge with a German circus, but she must learn the flying trapeze act so that she can blend in undetected, spurning the resentment of the lead aerialist, Astrid. At first rivals, Noah and Astrid soon forge a powerful bond, but as the facade that protects them proves increasingly tenuous, Noah and Astrid must decide whether their friendship is enough to save one another, or if the secrets that burn between them will destroy everything. When Pam Jenoff and I spoke, I asked her to talk about the true story from World War II that lies behind The Orphan's Tale. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
I tend to say inspired by a true story rather than based on, only because I like to make clear that what I'm doing is all fiction. So I would say that The Orphan's Tale was inspired by two true stories, and I found those stories when I was browsing through the virtual archives of Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Memorial or Museum in Israel. Mm-hmm. And they have something called the Database of the Righteous, and these are people who are known to have helped or saved someone's life.
Oh.
And in that database, I found two stories. One was a horrific account of what was called the Train of Unknown Children. And this was a boxcar or a train car full of children, too young to know their own name, taken from their parents and headed to a concentration camp. And from that horrific story, I literally just borrowed that image of the train, not the story itself. The second story was a remarkable, uplifting tale of what was called the Rescuer Circus. And this was a German circus that had saved Jews. And I've been working with the Holocaust and with history for more than two decades, and I had never heard of such a story. And I was completely captivated by that particular tale. from those two stories, I created my book. Noah, in my story, is a young Dutch girl who's 16, and she's been kicked out by her own parents. And she was kicked out because she became pregnant by a German soldier. And after being forced to give up her own baby, she's living above a German rail station alone and cleaning that station to earn her keep when she discovers this train of unknown infants. And in a moment of fateful impulse, she rescues one of the babies and flees into the night. And she finds shelter with a German circus that has sheltered Jews.
Right. And that's just a fascinating story. And I was very taken with both storylines. You have two narrators, Noah, as you just mentioned, and Astrid. So I wanted to know, as you started the book, what did you know about each of these women?
Well, I have sort of a strange writing process. I don't do character sketches or a lot of work ahead of time. And I'm sure you know that there's two types of writers. They say plotters and pantsers.
Right.
Plotters are those dear souls who write sentence by sentence in linear order and it comes out perfectly. That's not me. I'm a pantser, so-called, because one writes by the seat of your pants.
Right.
And so that's what I do. So I start my project with an image or an idea, and I turn on a computer or open a computer, and I go blah for like 60,000 words. And someone described this once as throwing up on the page, that image. But that's what I do. And I do that for 3 or 4 months until, you know, the blob of material just becomes too unwieldy. And that's when I start making the chapters and the outlines. And the reason I say that is, for me, the characters sort of come about in this organic way. You know, it's almost like chipping away at a fossil to see what's underneath.
Right. Okay. Now, I was very interested in the fact that both Noah and Astrid have been rejected by someone and are driven into the circus through, you know, their need to save themselves. And it strikes me that the circus has that reputation where, you know, a lot of misfits join the circus or people who aren't wanted elsewhere. And that seemed like an incredibly apt story for these women. Did you do a lot of research on the circus? And would you say that that's a true characterization of the people that join the circus?
So your question packed a lot of rich things into it, and I'd like to talk about each of them. The first is the notion that both Noah and Astrid have been kicked out. Noah, as we already spoke about, has been kicked out by her parents because she became pregnant. She's about 16. Astrid is very different. Astrid is almost 40 years old, and she's an aerialist. She came from a circus family. And the interesting part is, in researching this book, I discovered centuries of Jewish circus dynasties in Europe that I'd never heard of. And so it was fun for me to have Astrid be Jewish and have her come from one of those circus families. She left her own family to go marry a German officer in Berlin. And when the war starts, he's actually ordered to divorce his wife, and he does that. And that was another true bit of history about the German soldiers being sent home to divorce their Jewish spouses.
Mm-hmm.
So Astrid has now been kicked out by her German officer spouse. Her family's own circus, because they were Jewish, is no longer in existence. And so she finds herself with this neighboring circus, this circus that is rescuing Jews. It was a circus alongside her own family for years, a rival, and now she takes shelter with that circus as an aerialist. So they have both been kicked out.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's certainly true what you've said, that the circus is sort of this refuge for people, not really so much for, you know, strays and waifs and that sort of thing, actually very talented, gifted performers.
Mm-hmm.
But the circus does bring together all these different people. And one of the most interesting parts for me was in researching this, the real circus owner has some testimony where he says, "We circus folk see no difference as to race or religion."
Right.
And I just thought that was such an apt quote for the way these people come together.
Yeah.
And then you asked me if I did lots of research about the circus. I did. I don't necessarily love the circus myself. And when I discovered this topic, I wasn't sure I wanted to spend a year with the circus. I wasn't even sure I wanted to go see the circus as part of my research. And so there was a lot of soul searching. But what I found through my research was, first of all, a deep appreciation of the artistry and the skill that goes into not just the individual acts, but the staging of the circus, how they arrange the seats so that the energy flows, how they sequence the acts, and so on. So I really gained a deep appreciation for the circus arts. Additionally, you know, I discovered that these weren't just circus stories for me. These were really human stories of sort of love and redemption and courage.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's... As a story, it seemed like such an incredible, just so much potential to mirror the war and all of the things that were going on at the time. There's just so much going on in this book. So, and we'll get to some of that. I wanted to hop backwards for a minute and talk a little bit about the opening of the book. You open with kind of a, I can't remember if you called it a prologue, but it's a scene from the narrative's future. And it's a scene that has a lot of intrigue, and I was drawn right in. So I wanted to talk a little bit about satisfying beginnings and endings. I don't want to give away the ending of the book, but I just wondered if you could talk generally as an author about your opinion of satisfying openings and endings.
Certainly. So obviously you want an opening that's going to paint a vivid scene or image. And I start so often with that image when I begin writing with some sort of idea. And to me, a prologue and an epilogue can form sort of this neat arc of question and answer. So in our prologue in The Orphan's Tale, we see an elderly woman who's made her way from the United States to France, you know, under great difficulty for a circus exhibition in the present day. And she sneaks into the exhibit, and she's quite clearly looking for something, but we don't necessarily know who she is or what she's looking for. Mm-hmm. And those are the questions that the book seeks to answer. You know, when you write historical fiction, it's a funny sort of thing whether you go with pure historical fiction. Some authors toggle back and forth every chapter, present and historical. That's not the case with this book. It's just bookended by the present-day prologue and epilogue.
Right, right. And I was interested that you choose to go back and forth between Noah and Astrid's points of view, and that I was surprised at a certain point I noticed that it wasn't necessarily every other one. Like, sometimes Noah would get two in a row, sometimes Astrid. Well, I'm trying to remember if Astrid got two in a row. Probably she did. But so I realized that at a certain point you were just letting the story sort of unfold from each of their points of view, but whatever it needed at that moment is what you were giving it. Is that true?
It is. I mean, when I started, the natural inclination for symmetry was Noah Astrid. But at certain points, the story, you know, someone's story needs to unfurl or events need to be told from a certain point of view. And if you try and stay with that, it's just too rigid. So I aspired to give them roughly equal time in the book. It's just not always sequentially alternating. Interestingly, right now, I'm working with something that has three different points of view, uh-huh. And I'm just trying to decide how that balance is going to work out. So
yeah.
It's a timely question.
Well, three is a good one for that, because like if you braid something, remember how braids sometimes seem to have two on one side and one on the other, and then it kind of, it's never completely
I like
even.
That. I can't do my children's hair, but I like the concept in the abstract.
I liked that the desperate circumstances of the war allowed you to establish sort of early on a defensive antagonism between these two women. It really fed the story early when they first meet each other. There's a certain amount of dislike or competition or just worry about what will this person being in my life do for my own safety and future. And I really thought that fed the story well, and I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that.
Certainly. So first, I like what you said about the dire circumstances, you know, in general. One of my favorite things about writing World War II, The Orphan's Tale is my ninth book, and many of them are set around the Second World War, is that I always want to take my reader and put her in the shoes of my protagonist and have her ask, like, what would I have done in these circumstances? And the war is just so stark and the choices were so dire that it's really perfect ground for storytelling. And then specifically with respect to here, we have two protagonists, right? So we can put you in the shoes of both women and have you ask these questions. For me, this is really about the secrets. If you think about it, when Noah comes to the circus with the baby and she's on the run, the circus owner says, you can stay here, but in order to blend in, you're going to have to become part of the circus. And I think you should become an aerialist. And then he sort of puts a heavy hand on Astrid and says, you have to teach her how to be an aerialist, which is no small feat when she's never been on a trapeze at 16.
Right.
Astrid doesn't like Noah. First of all, she doesn't think Noah can do it with respect to the trapeze. She doesn't believe the stories that Noah's telling about where she's come from and who she is, and she thinks that Noah brings unwanted attention to the circus. So she's got a lot of resentment at the beginning, and pretty quickly things start to shift. We see Astrid needing Noah more, but the overall tension of that book is, of the whole story, is whether they can save each other or whether their secrets will destroy them both.
Right, yeah. Well, one thing that I really loved about it, because these two women both have something to hide, the circus is just this perfect metaphor, and I think, in fact, you even use this line somewhere in the book, that they are hiding in plain sight. And that's a delicate balance. Like you say, Astrid has to worry that Noah is going to bring too much attention to the circus, and that at that point, Astrid's worried about her own secrets. She doesn't know about Noah's secrets. But that was a really interesting plot moment when I realized, these women are really literally hiding in plain sight. And that was just a kind of a neat moment. I don't think I have a question about it.
That worked.
So do you mind if I read a really short section and then we can talk about it? Okay. This is in Noah's point of view. This is a couple paragraphs. The program of the circus, Astrid explained once, is deliberately designed, a fast act, then a slow one, then fast again. Lions and other dangerous animals interspersed with human pantomimes. You want the light bits after serious, she'd said, like cleansing the palate after each course of a meal. But there are practicalities, too, such as the time needed to bring the animal cages in and out that makes placing them close to intermission a necessity. Watching, I realize that the design of the big top is deliberate, too. The angles of the benches are steep to face the gaze downward. The rounding seating makes the crowd play off one another's responses, and the unbroken circle is like a wire for the electricity that fills the tent. The audience sits motionless, mesmerized by the web of color, lights, music, and artistry. Their eyes dance with the arc of the juggler's balls, and they gasp in appreciation as one of the trainers waltzes with a lion. Astrid was right. Even as war rages on, the people still have to live. They shop for their foodstuffs and tend to their homes. Why not laugh at the circus as they had when the world was still whole? So I loved that section. First of all, because it sort of takes us there and we get to see how it's all laid out and how it's designed to work. But also it really nicely tells us about the comedy and tragedy within the world of the circus and within the war. Just the fact that people are trying to live normal lives within a very abnormal situation, and the comedy and tragedy living side by side was really important to me there as a reader. So did you think a lot about that while you were writing this?
I did. And first of all, thank you. I don't know if anyone's ever read my work to me, so I appreciate it. That passage, interestingly, is exactly where I was trying to weave in the thought and planning and skill that goes behind the circus without sort of giving a big dump of historical information. Just as an aside, recently I was asked for an article to find the bit in the book where it talks about Jewish circus dynasties. And I knew I had written something about this, a paragraph. I could hear it in my mind.
Right.
But I couldn't find the paragraph when I went through the final manuscript, and I realized that's because I'm not allowed to just dump history in where I think it's interesting. And at some point, myself or my editor had worked together and woven that into other parts. So there actually was no freestanding paragraph about that. I couldn't find it, which is interesting.
Yeah.
So here what I'm trying to do is weave in some of that skill and planning that goes into the circus. And it's interesting to see whether it comes from Noah's point of view, from really experiencing the circus for the first time, or Astrid's point of view of just understanding the role that this entertainment played in people's lives. Two very different views on that. But throughout my books, I think I've wrestled with this question of the ordinary life alongside what was going on. So although I've written much about World War II, I very seldom go into the concentration camps. And Orphan's Tale doesn't really, it's probably my darkest book, but it doesn't quite go there. But I was writing an earlier book, my first book, Commandant's Girl, and I had this scene where people were at the orchestra. And I remember at that point seeing Band of Brothers, which is just so visceral with the liberation of a concentration camp. And I said, well, I stopped writing. I thought, who am I to be writing dinner parties and the orchestra when that was happening 45 kilometers away? And the answer I came to was, well, those things were really going on 45 kilometers away. And so what I'm doing is I'm telling another side of the war, another side of the story. And I feel like this with the circus as well. You know, it's another side of what was going on. But we see that the veneer between the circus and the horrors of the outside world is incredibly thin in some places where those horrors encroach right into the circus and right into the show.
Absolutely. And there's another moment, which I'm not going to go looking for right now, but there's this beautiful, beautiful paragraph that exposes another one of those same well, I'm just going to say that, you know, it exposes the seediness behind the shine of the circus is what I'll say, right? So there's this moment where Noah sees it sort of fresh in this moment where she sees sort of like the dusty pillows and I can't remember, but, it, you know, and that almost like is like a little microcosm of the shine of the circus against the horror of the war. And I thought that was really beautiful, too. I don't know if that was done on purpose, but I thought maybe...
Yes, it's kind of what it looks like the next day. So I agree completely. And one thing I have to say that I struggled with in my research, you know, you always wrestle with how much history and how much fiction. And also, at some points, you just don't have history to be accurate with. There just isn't a record. So, for example, I knew that this rescuer circus had gone on during the war, but I didn't know how it had gone on. You know, I knew it had gone on and it had hidden people as part of the act. So it must have been going on. But the geography and sort of the when and where of the circus was very much a mystery in my research. And so I had to speculate as to where a circus would have been allowed to continue and how that would have been juxtaposed with the realities of the war, like broken train lines or, you know, or fighting or that sort of thing. That was all speculative on my part because there just wasn't enough information. I mean, I knew a circus would have done better in France than in Poland, let's say. You know, it was more plausible to go west, but I had to imagine a lot of that.
Yeah, that makes sense. Was it frustrating to you? Like, if there are certain things that you feel like, you know, everything's so accessible to us on the internet now, but I mean, it must be frustrating to try to go back in time and find something that you would find immediately right now if you Googled it. You know, like, how long did it take a train from this place to that place?
We do spend a lot of time trying to figure out those things and trying to make sure that we're not putting a modern layer of history, you know, modern things on it, what should be historically accurate. And there's also, you know, some things that are incredible. About a week and a half ago, I received an email from a woman who is the descendant of the real life Astrid. You know, she's like the descendant of the woman who inspired my aerialist.
Oh,
and
wow.
She was thanking me, which was amazing. But I thought, oh, to have had access to her when I was writing this book.
Yeah, right. So, you know, you mentioned that you've done a lot of work. I think you mentioned this. I know in your bio it says that you used to work in the Pentagon and the State Department and that work dipped you into a lot of information about World War II. So how can we just talk about the work that you used to do and how that has fed your fiction?
Certainly. So my first experience when I got it, I received a master's degree in history. I was over at Cambridge. And when I came back to the U.S., I took a job as the special assistant to the Secretary of the Army, and that was at the Pentagon. And I refer to that year as the year that I saw the world from the shoulders of giants. That's paraphrasing Sir Isaac Newton's quote. But I traveled with my boss to the 50th anniversary of World War II commemorations around the globe and saw, to Bastogne in Belgium, Corregidor in the Philippines, and to Slovakia and all sorts of places. So that was, number one, my first real exposure to Eastern Europe and that part of the world. And second, a really just a rich history of the war. From there, I moved over to the State Department. I was a foreign service officer, a junior diplomat, and I was sent to Krakow, Poland for several years.
Oh, wow.
I didn't go to work on the war. I actually went to stamp visas and passports and help Americans when they got in trouble abroad. But at that moment of time, it was the mid-90s, and Poland had just come out of decades of communism where they could not have an open conversation. And as a result, many of their issues from World War II were unresolved in the 90s, and they had to resolve those issues in order to join NATO and the European Union. So I was on the ground in Poland, a young woman by myself, and I had become very close to the Holocaust survivors in Krakow. And the U.S. government gave me responsibility for that portfolio of work. So anything that came up from the war or the Holocaust in southern Poland, I was very closely involved with. And it was work that was both incredibly difficult and at the same time really transformative in my life. And so coming out of those years is really where I got my inspiration to write about the war.
That all came before your first novel?
It did. So I did a tour in Poland about 2.5 years, and then I did not continue on as a diplomat. I left, and I went to law school, of all things, and I graduated from law school in 2001. And really where I became a writer had to do with 9/11. So I had always wanted to be a writer. I'd never gotten started. And I began practicing law on September 4th, 2001.
Oh, my gosh.
Exactly 1 week to the day before 9/11. And when 9/11 happened, I had this life epiphany. I was like, it's fine to be a lawyer, but wait a minute, I always wanted to be a writer. If I was a 9/11 victim, I never would have written a book, you know? I never would have realized my dream, and I did not have forever. So I took a night course at Temple Night School in Philadelphia, and that course was called Write Your Novel This Year. And it's now called Write Your Novel This Month. That sounds really scary. But I took Write Your Novel This Year, and I began to work on my first book. But there were two catches. One is that I was still a new attorney at a big city law firm, and I had $1,000 a month to repay in student loan debt. So I used to write my novels from 5 to 7 in the morning before I went to the firm every day for many years. And the other catch, of course, is it's great that I was serious about writing, but it was still 5 years and 39 publisher rejections until the last known publisher on earth bought that first book.
So how long did it take you to find an agent then?
I'm trying to remember. Back then it was all snail mail. There was no email at that point. And so I did the usual querying. I made mistakes. Like I queried before my manuscript was polished, which was a huge mistake. And I found a wonderful agent, and he helped me get the book in shape and then submitted it. We spent a year working on it. Then we submit the book, and it's crickets. You know, it's silence at that point. Everyone rejects the book. And he said to me, go write another book, as if it were that easy. Go write another book, and we'll sell that one first. So I was toiling away on another book for 11 months. And oh my goodness, I just missed the anniversary because it was April 7th or April 8th, right? So I've just missed it by a few days. April 7th or April 8th, 2005. And my phone rang at the law firm on a Friday afternoon. I saw my agent's number pop up on caller ID, and I thought, this can't be good because no one ever calls you, right? So I picked up the phone. I said, are you firing me? And he said, because like a poor guy hadn't made a dime off of me. And he said, no, I'm calling to tell you I sold the book. And so one publisher still had it, and they made a tiny little offer, and off we went.
So that was the first book, and you had not quite finished the second book.
No, that was the first book, right? We wound up going, he sold the original manuscript.
Oh, that's fantastic.
It was wonderful. I really should have... I should have thanked him because it's Throwback Thursday, so I should thank him.
You can still thank him, and it's a sign that you're not hanging on to that, that you've moved forward and your career is doing very well, so that's good.
Well, finally, but I have to say, as a writer, like that date stands out in my mind so vividly. Exactly.
Yeah. I want to just hop back to an earlier point, and that is the bit that I read. Astrid lets Noah know what the structure of the circus acts is like. You know, there's the fast act and the slow one, then the fast one. You do light after serious. And all of this made me think about how, as a writer, I might structure a novel about the subject of the circus. I wondered if you used any of the circus design toward a structure as you drafted The Orphan's Tale.
That would have been really smart. I did not do that. But I remember, it's funny. Sometimes, sometimes research means going places. I know writers who can take 4 trips to Italy for a single book, and that would be lovely were it not for the day job and the kids. But sometimes the best research is simple library research. And I still can picture the book I read that just laid out the circus artistry in such clear terms for me about the seating and the sequencing and all of that. And it was really it was really quite memorable.
Yeah. No, it was very engaging, too. I enjoyed reading about how that all works. So when you do research, do you do a lot of book time and library time, or do you do a lot of internet time, or is it all of the above?
It's actually all of the above. It's funny, when we talk about historical research, I always say that there are 3 questions. How you do the research, how you incorporate the research, and how you don't screw up the research.
Right.
I think those are sort of the big 3. But research for me can take many forms. The internet is a wonder. I like maps. I like periodicals from the era. I like photographs. I love correspondence back and forth. You know, if it's a war book, for example, from the home front, there's a lot of correspondence. For circuses, there's a lot of websites. There's a Circopedia. But you have to be very careful not to confuse U.S. and European circuses, because they were quite different. Mm-hmm. And then I had to do a lot of research also with respect to aerial arts, not just the circus in general. So had to learn a lot about what would have been plausible for Noah to do as a new aerialist starting so late. And then I had an aerialist on retainer. And by on retainer, I mean she was helping me for free. But she would answer all of my questions, which I didn't know what to ask her until the very end, about how do you throw someone and, you know, those sorts of things.
Yeah.
I needed to know how many people for this kind of act, and would it be possible to land here, et cetera, et cetera.
Did you do any immersion? Did you go and swing on a bar or sit on a swing or anything to get
no
a sense?
No authors were harmed in the making of this book. No, I did not. I did not go. I did not go to the circus. I was purely theoretical research. And she sent me video clips and that sort of thing. But it's probably not something I would have done. I'm not very brave.
Okay, that's fine. Well, you couldn't have told. I thought it was very well rendered. Let's talk about the title of the book, The Orphan's Tale. How did you come to that? Or maybe Mira Publishing came to that?
Well, let me say, very few book titles ever stay what they started as. So almost every single book I've ever read has changed titles in some form, and this one was no exception. So my working title was The Aerialist. And then at some point they said, we don't like it, it's too circusy. There was a whole debate, you know, internally with the publishing team. And I gave suggestions, and we went around and around, and we came up with The Orphan's Tale. And I think there's a couple things about it. First of all, the question in this book is really, who's the orphan? You know, because it may be the child that gets rescued. We don't know if that child's parents are alive or dead. It could be Noah being kicked out. It could be Astrid, whose family has gone missing. There's a lot of sort of metaphorical ways we could use orphan in this book. The other question, of course, is it too derivative of Orphan Train by Christina Baker Klein? And she's a dear friend, and I've said that to her many times. But, you know, it's such a distinct topic, really.
Yeah, no, it absolutely is. And although there is a train on the cover, that's interesting. I didn't think about that until you said that.
And a quote from Christina.
That's true, yeah. Funny. Okay. Let's see. So circuses have been in the news a lot lately. The Flying Willendas had an accident in February where a number of people were hurt. And the Ringling Brothers just shut down the greatest show on earth, or is about to. So I just wondered if you've been, like, do you follow all the circus news and sort of, you're not into the circus, it sounds like, but have you become sort of involuntarily fascinated?
Well, let me say this. So I don't have like a circus Google alert set so that circus stories come up, but I think that the Ringling Brothers story is actually a really interesting parallel to what went on in my book. So if you think about Ringling Brothers, I think the last show may have been in Philadelphia or somewhere, you know, recently in the past few months. And so the circus was weakened over time, and it was weakened by circumstance. It was weakened by people, you know, having a reaction to the animal acts and animal rights. It was weakened by other forms of entertainment taking over for people. And all those factors go into the demise. And much the same could be said of those European circuses, such as the Jewish circus dynasties. They were weakened by the Great War. They were weakened by the Depression, and people started going to the movies instead of to the circus and all of these things, so that when the war knocks it out, it's kind of just the final blow. So I feel like there's a lot of parallels in the ways the circuses decline.
Yeah, and actually, now that you say that, it occurs to me that there would have been sort of a human rights evolution where probably people were very turned off by some of the sideshow acts and some of those very sad people that were on display, you know, and now it's the animals, you know, that we've come to that point. But that's interesting. Okay, I wanted to just mention one other thing that I thought was so interesting as I read this book. It became really interesting to me to think about danger. And there's the danger of hiding, the danger of war, the danger of the high wire, and the irony of flying versus hiding. Did you work a lot with kind of keeping that thread running through the book?
One theme that I always see in writing about the war is hiding versus fleeing. I've had that in other books. I wrote a book called The Winter Guest, and there were twin sisters, and one wanted to hide and one wanted to flee. So I've thought about that theme a lot. But it becomes particularly acute with the trapeze, right? Because
sure.
The circus is sort of like, first of all, the circus itself is kind of tethered. They get to travel, but only so far. They're going to be accountable if somebody doesn't come back. And so there's a lot of questions there. And same with the trapeze, you know, there's this notion of like, if only we could fly out of here. So it's very much a caged bird sort of feeling.
Absolutely. Yeah. It was very interesting to read about that. You know, Astrid in particular is very focused on being able to kind of fly and whether she's going to be able to fly again. And, yeah, that's great. Let's see. Okay, Pam, I wanted to just ask you as a reader instead of as an author, have you read anything lately that you would recommend to listeners?
Oh my goodness, I read constantly. So I'm very lucky. I go to these book conferences and I just like greedily scoop up books and then try and carry them home. So I have read many wonderful things lately, both that are already out and are going to come out, and both that are historical fiction, but also suspense. So I really enjoyed The Chilbury Ladies' Choir by Jennifer Ryan. A book is coming out in June called The Lost Letter by Gillian Cantor. If you like more of the more on the women's fiction side, The Forever Summer by Jamie Brenner is coming out in April. If you like more history or mystery or suspense, I love Mary Kubica and Heather Gudenkauf. So I can just go on and on.
Yeah.
There are, you know, some really good places online where people are getting together and talking about what they read all of the time. And I enjoy those groups very much. So, I do encourage everyone to reach out to me on social media, Facebook or Twitter, and I'm happy to point to you where I'm getting my reading ideas from.
Oh, okay, great. Are you on Goodreads a lot too?
I'm on Goodreads, Facebook, Twitter. I try Instagram. I'm not very good at it. And I did something recently that was fun. I did something called my 100 Days of Reading, or 100 Days of Books, where every day for 100 days I recommended a different book that I liked. And
oh, interesting.
So for that, I actually used Pinterest. I'm not a Pinterest person, but it was the best way to keep track of all 100 books.
Yeah, I'm on Pinterest, and I always use it to post my guests' covers, but I've fallen way behind, and I need to get back on that.
It's for crafty people and people who can cook, and I am neither, so
yeah.
I'm afraid not. But I did 100 Days of Books, and I'm happy to share that with people. Those are books that I like.
I also wanted to ask you what you're working on now, if you're writing anything new. I know you're doing a book tour, so you're probably pretty busy, but have you started another project?
Well, I was supposed to have finished another one by Memorial Day, although it's looking more like Labor Day at the moment. I did find, you know, between the two jobs, the three kids, I did find the travel schedule for the book was amazing, and I'm so, so grateful for it. But it did cripple my writing this winter and spring. So I am working on a book. It was inspired by a true story again, and it deals with 12 women who were spies for Britain during the war, and they went missing in occupied Europe, never to be heard from again. So the story is sort of looking at what might have happened to them.
Oh, interesting. Oh, that's a really nice segue, actually, to my very last question for you, which is, if you have advice for listeners who are writers, for finding good stories from history and turning them to fiction, and I think I actually mean finding the stories, like where do you look and how do you recognize them as good material?
It's really interesting because number one, sometimes I just have an idea I want to work with. Other times, like this book I went looking for, and it was simply, I went through archives for months of different museums and different historical sites, and you know, stood in Barnes & Noble and browsed the historical rack, and went to my independent bookstore and browsed their historical rack in the library, and was just looking and looking. And I don't believe in writer's block, but this was the first time I came close. I was like, what is my next idea? Because part of the problem is, it's not enough to simply have an idea anymore. I believe that in this really tight book climate that we're in, it kind of has to be a big idea. So candidly, there are many times that there are things I'd love to write about, and one of my publishing people just says, no, like that's not it. It's equal parts for me, art and commerce. So it's not just finding a story, it's finding the story. And so there are some stories that are huge. So there's a book coming out sometime, I think at the beginning of June, by Lisa Wingate, and it's called Before We Were Yours. And I don't think I have this, I don't think I can read the book because it sounds so emotional. But it was this story about this adoption practice in Tennessee of taking people's children and putting them up for adoption. And it's inspired by a true event. I don't want to misstate her book, but I think that idea is one of those that everybody goes, my goodness, why didn't I find that one? You know, because it's so huge. Or Orphan Train. It's got to be something true, but something that just grips at the gut. It's not enough just to find a true story. Because I actually think real life makes terrible plot, but it makes for great setting.
Oh, interesting. I just want to mention one more time, the novel is called The Orphan's Tale by Pam Genoff, and it's published by Mira Books. Pam, thank you so much for speaking with me today. This was a great pleasure.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're listening to WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, and that was an interview with the author, Pam Genoff. You can read more about her work at pamgenoff.com. I just want to mention again that this show is generously underwritten by Burlington City Arts, a public arts organization located at 135 Church Street that connects the community to the arts through free contemporary arts exhibitions, special music and cultural events, art classes and workshops, and a print and clay studio, soon to be located at 407 Pine Street. On exhibition now at Burlington City Arts, Shane Lavallette's One Sun, One Shadow, Wiley Sophia Garcia's With My Voice, I Am Calling You Home, The Past Present, work by Molly Bosley and Athena Petra Tassiopoulos. Free entrance Tuesday to Friday, 11 to 5, Saturday, 11 to 8, and Sunday, 11 to 5. More information always available at burlingtoncityarts.org. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com. As free podcasts, you can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates, and you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. You can also stream the show live each week at 99.3wbtv.org. That's every Monday at 3. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And if you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell your friends about it. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book on WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Have a great week.